What's up, Dialed fam? Happy Monday, and welcome to episode 140 of the Dialed Health Podcast. My name is Derek Teal. I'm the owner and head coach here at dialedhealth.com, and today is a very special episode because I get to sit down with Education First's very own Nielsen Paulus, and he is fresh off of a race win in France at the Cycliste de Marseille. We're going to dive into the day talking about the ride profile. We're also going to go into his tactics coming into the day and ultimately what played out from his perspective during the race. You're also going to hear about what made him decide to go on the solo breakaway to win just like he did, how he paced it, and then we talk about nutrition, what he ate for his pre-race meal. We talk about what he ate immediately before the start of the race and then all the way during this 4.5 hour effort. After that, he gives you some incredible advice that I think you can really put into play next time you are racing yourself. And what's so cool about this episode is the timing. We recorded this the day after this victory in France, and it was the day before he started the Étoile de Bessèges, and I know I'm butchering that, but it's a 5-day stage race in France. And spoiler alert, it went really well. Basically, on the penultimate stage, he ended up second in GC, and day 5 was a time trial with a crazy mountain finish. And he ended up taking over GC by 1 second at the end of the day, and watching it was legendary. If you guys don't have GCN Plus, I highly recommend getting it. In fact, I got it specifically so I can start watching Nielsen more because he's a friend of mine, he's from my hometown, and he's one of the best cyclists in the world. So please enjoy this interview and stick around because after it, we're gonna go into a good old-fashioned update. This is really for the members of the Dialed fam, and I wanna tell you guys what I've been into. Now, you can probably tell, my voice is jacked up right now because I've been sick, and we'll talk about that. But thankfully, we recorded this episode with Nielsen before my voice sounded like I had a frog in my throat. So enjoy the episode, and I'll talk to you guys after. All right, Nielsen, huge congrats on your win at the Grand Prix Cycliste de Marseille.
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, glad to be here.
Dude, I want to go into your perspective about what happened at the race. But I also want to give people insight as to what the day like. So I have the ride profile pulled up right now. The distance, total day, 104.71 miles. That's 167.1 kilometers. Elevation gain, 9,587 feet. Also 2,893 meters vert. Total moving time is 4 hours and 27 minutes, which is absolutely bonkers. I saw the average speed is 23.5 miles an hour. For a 100 plus mile day with almost 10K of climbing, that blows my mind. And you burned over 4,000 calories. Now we go into the ride analysis and we have an average power of 259, but a weighted average power of 303. And I'm gonna be honest, that number right there kind of hurt my brain. We have a max power of just over 1,000 watts and we have a training load of 257. So an absolutely savage day on the bike, let alone the idea that you didn't stop. It's not like this is a Fondo. I have to remind myself these things. This is not a normal bike ride. You're racing the whole time. So from your perspective, can you give me a breakdown of how the day went start to finish?
Yeah, it was definitely a pretty stout day in the end. It's a pretty hilly 1-day race and it's kind of open to anyone. So there's kind of a mix of sprinters and climbers and punchers. And for the most of the day, I knew I just had to save as much energy as possible. So I was pretty much just hiding in the peloton for the first, I would say, 3 hours or 2.5 hours, just never letting myself touch any wind and just stayed in the bunch and tried to stay safe and fuel, really. And it all just came down to everybody knew that the race was going to explode on this pretty steep climb, about 50K to go, which I think is about 30, 34 miles or something like that, maybe. I just knew I had to be in position there. So just spent the whole like first half of the day really just saving energy and biding my time until it was my turn to, you know, show my stuff and do what I could on the steep climb, because that's in the past, that's always where the race kicks off for real. And it's all about just getting to that point as fresh as possible.
Yeah. So when you started the day, did you really intend on going out and winning this thing?
I was one of the options. So part of the strategy our team had and the strategy we were lucky enough to have was that we really had three feasible options to win this race. One of them was myself. Another was Marijn Vandenberg. He just had won a sprint in Mallorca a few days before. So we knew he was going to be, you know, pretty competitive if it came down to a sprint. And then the third option was my teammate Ben Healy, who was also just third in another race in Mallorca in the previous week. So we came there with three good options, which gave our team a lot of confidence. And I think it also just showed in the way I rode when I did get up the road. You know, I had the confidence that if our group had gotten caught by the peloton, that I would have some fresh legs from some strong teammates right behind me. So I never felt any pressure to like push the pace myself.
So when you said you put yourself in position to attack on that major climb with about 50K to go, when you made that move, who went with you?
Yeah, it was a bit of a washing machine for a little while. I think a lot of riders were pretty nervous about bringing Arnaud Dely to the line because he probably was the strongest sprinter in the race, and he finished, I think, in the top five of the World Tour ranking last year because he won like 13 races and he had already won a race this year. So he's a super strong young sprinter, and a lot of guys wanted to make that steep climb hard to try to get rid of him, which worked out in my favor, because compared to the rest of the riders there, I felt quite a bit stronger than most on the steep climb. And the goal was really just to follow. In the pre-race meeting, our director had told us, you know, we have a good option with Marijn. Go with the moves, just follow. Like, you don't need to put yourself in the wind and really drive something to go away. Like, follow them, and if you end up in a good group, we'll you know, decide what to do. And I mean, that's what ended up happening. I just followed the wheels. I knew which guys were stronger, which guys could probably potentially make it to the line. And I essentially just followed them, stayed just well within myself, never showed too much. And then once I got in the group, it was just about, you know, the whole time I was just thinking about when's the best opportunity to get away. Because when you're rolling in a group that big, half of them don't really want to push hard. They just want to save as much as possible, and nobody wants to do more than anyone else. So I knew if I was alone, I probably could go faster than the group, because I could just give it everything. And yeah, that's what kind of led to me going off on my own, because I knew if I had enough time at the top of the final climb that no one was going to take any time back on me on the descent, because I knew I could go downhill quite a bit faster than most of the guys in the race. And it's also just, you know, really fast all the way to the finish from the top of that last climb. So when I got, you know, the call on the radio that I had the freedom to go, I just went for it and went all in, just fully committed. Luckily, it worked out.
So you're in the breakaway and you realize, okay, you know, people are trying to pace this thing out. Obviously, we've done enough to split away from the group, but it's not like you're going full in that group. And so am I correct about, it was about 13K to go is when you made that move to punch it. So was there something in particular? Was it like, okay, top of the climb, I can descend faster than these guys and it's a perfect way to gap out? Was that the mindset and as to why you broke away there?
Yeah. My director in the car, TJ Van Garderen, actually had told me that the kicker at the bottom of that descent would be a good launch pad. So in my mind, I was waiting until that point. But when I looked behind me and I saw I had a gap, it was like, yeah, like, oh man, they just gave me a gap. Like, they just gave me 5 seconds. They're out of the draft. Like, let's just go. I was going to go anyways. So yeah, I figured I didn't want to waste the gap that they gave me. So I just pressed into it, and luckily had some good legs on the day as well. Felt super strong the whole day, and I knew I was coming into it pretty fit due to a pretty successful winter of training. But yeah, in the end, it was a suffer fest all the way to the top of that climb, because it's not the steepest climb. Maybe the first K and a half, it's a steep part, but then I think for the whole final climb, I averaged about 33 or 34 K an hour, which is maybe 22 miles per hour or something like that. And it was into a headwind, so all I had to think about was just staying as small as I could. It wasn't necessarily about the watts I was pushing. It was all about speed, because I could stand up on that climb and push 50 watts more, but my speed would drop by, you know, 5K an hour. So I just had to keep it seated, keep it fast, compromise on power output just for speed. And that's kind of the way it had to go all the way to the line.
As you said, get small, it reminded me of the last ride that we actually did together. We were coming down Auburn Folsom. And for the non-locals listening, which is the majority of people, it's a 1% downgrade for, I don't know, 8 miles or something like that. Yeah. And so when you're pace lining, the speed gets up super quick and you came out in front and like, I just got to witness what you mean by getting small. And yeah. It was amazing to see how aero your body got and how smooth you stayed on the pedals. And I'll be honest with you, we were still throwing down more watts than I would normally, but I'm sure for you, it was within, you know, realistic output that you can maintain for a while. But I guess I just have that visual. And so it's cool knowing exactly what you're saying about the aero advantage really it comes into play when climbs especially aren't as steep. Then I think about you breaking away and it almost gives me like a level of anxiety of to think about like this, you know, group chasing me and to understand how hard to push and how to not blow up because you still have 13K to go. So for you, like what's your mindset? Are you just listening to the radio and being like, okay, am I gapping or am I not gapping? And are you using that as your determining factor of whether or not to push? Like how the heck do you pace that last 13?
Luckily the day before we had done some recon and we rode that final climb. So I knew exactly how long it was going to be. And I roughly knew about how much time it was going to take to get to the top. And honestly, my finish line was the top of that climb. I knew just based on how the day went and how confident I was in my ability to descend that if I just got to the top of that climb in front with just barely enough space that it was pretty likely I would be able to take it to the line. So it was really just metering my effort to the top of that climb. And I mean, I knew the gaps. I was getting updates on the gaps, but it was really just as fast as I could to the top of that climb. I wasn't really easing off when the gap went out or speeding up when the gap came closer. I just tried to go as fast as I possibly could. Yeah, just try not to think about everything else going on because at the end of the day, I couldn't have gone any faster to the top of that climb. So
yeah. You basically were more concerned about pacing to the top of that climb than you were even while you were on the solo breakaway.
Yeah, basically. I knew I had a gap and I roughly knew that if I was, you know, pushing over 400 watts, that closing a gap of 30 seconds is a like they'd have to be very organized and they'd have to be pushing, you know, 450 to 500 on the front to close that gap by the top of the climb. Mm-hmm. So I knew that as long as I stayed consistent, I never had a, you know, if I never have a big blow up, if I just, you know, stay constant on the power, keep the speed as high as possible, that would give me my best chance of making it to the top with a gap. And it was a bit of a stair-steppy climb. So, you know, I would ease off when it would flatten out. There was even a false flat downhill for part of it. And I would just try to use that to get some recovery in and just, you know, get a lot more aero and really ease off of the power, just, you know, compromise on a little bit of speed, but give myself a lot of power. You can save quite a lot on a flat road by just getting smaller. And then as soon as the road would go uphill, then I would focus a bit more on power, you know, try to stay small the whole time, but the balance would shift kind of more towards power output as opposed to aerodynamics. And it was just all about that balance the whole way up through every stair step.
That is so cool to hear about the change in focus as the terrain changes just to ride your fastest. It's definitely a lot of experience coming through your actual race day, which is really cool. Now, at what point did you feel 100% like you locked it up? Because obviously you felt that way at the top of the climb before you did the solo breakaway, but you still got to get across the line. We all know anything can happen. So was there a feeling of just total relief and the stoke hits you like I won this thing? Like at what point does that happen? Because I saw the video of like the look back before you sat up before coming across the line, but when did it really hit you? Like, oh, okay, I'm locking this thing in.
It hit me the second I stood up, looked back and didn't see them. To be honest, I knew when I got to the top of the climb that, okay, now I've got a good chance. It wasn't really until then that I really told myself that I could really win it. But once I got to the top of that climb with a big enough gap, I knew that I had a chance to win it. And I just focused everything on speed, getting to the line as fast as possible. And just, you know, consistent speed was the biggest thing and taking the corners as fast as I could, never, you know, scrubbing as little speed as possible around every corner. Yeah, I was, to be honest, I was having a hard time, you know, understanding how long I had to go to the finish, because on that descent, the air was so cold that it really blurred my vision. Yeah, I had glasses on, and it's not like I was just getting wind straight to the face, but the air was just so cold in some of those pockets going tucked into the mountain that by the time I got off to the descent, I was really just following the white line on the road, because I couldn't see signs. I couldn't read the K's to go. I couldn't really see too well. So I was really just, you know, hearing what my director was saying in my ear, telling me how many K I had to go. And that was really my only reference point, because I couldn't see the K's to go on the side of the road anymore. And I was just like, you know, following the white line, trying to just keep it straight and get to the line as fast as I could. And once I got into the finish straight and saw 500 to go, by the time that, because I could see that sign, and I could see this big old banner, like big old white banner above the road. And then I was like, okay, yeah, I think I'm close enough now.
That is awesome. And it actually takes me to a question that we got from Jonathan Lee, and he reached out, or actually I saw him watching you while he was doing a turbo session himself, and he was so fired up, and, you know, fellow American. And I reached out to him and said, hey, do you have any questions that you want me to ask Nielsen? And he asked about you looking at road signs and wondered if that was kind of what cued you into your pacing on your solo breakaway. So we kind of got that answered. But one thing he wanted to also know that I really want to know was about your fueling for the day, and especially fueling on the bike. It'd be great if we could hear like quickly what you ate the morning of, and then kind of what you ate on the bike. Let's start with the morning of, and then kind of through the race.
Yeah. Morning of, I mean, all day, it's definitely lots of carbs. Morning of, we were staying in a French hotel. We didn't have a team chef with us here, because normally I'd have like, you know, some pancakes and like some sourdough pancakes and some rice, omelet. But we were staying in a French hotel, and they actually had nice bread in the morning, so I actually ended up just going for 5 pieces of this sliced baguette that they had, and, you know, it was quite a hefty chunk of bread. It probably equal out to about, you know, 5 slices of sliced bread, maybe 5 or 6, and yeah, a couple of eggs on the side. They had hard boiled eggs set out, so I took a couple of those, and then I think I had a little bit of maybe like a cup of oatmeal as well, with just normal milk. Some honey, some blueberries.
Did you put butter on your toast? I'm just curious.
Yeah, butter and...
Yeah, butter it up.
Butter and jelly.
Yep.
Yeah. That's kind of, yeah, a pretty straightforward breakfast, just a little bit more than an average breakfast, but, you know, a normal breakfast, I guess.
So if you looked at the macros of that breakfast, it'd be carbs number one priority. And then it looks like you have a decent amount of fat just through the butter, a little bit in the milk and egg yolk. And then you have just enough protein to make sure you're not going to wither away. Is what it kind of sounds like.
Yeah. Basically just the oatmeal and the eggs. I basically throw that in to just make it all last a bit longer, just so I don't, you know, just so it digests a little bit slower, because we tend to eat about 3.5 hours before start time. So because you're eating a pretty hefty amount of food, so you just need time to digest that and let it soak into your muscles a little bit before the start. And I might have like maybe a rice cake, like the cycling rice cakes that the team makes. I might have one of those before the start. But yeah, typically just the breakfast is the pre-race meal with maybe a small snack right before the start. And then getting into the race, since the start of the year, I've only been racing on 90, like, we're sponsored by Never Second, and they make a high carb drink mix with 90 grams of carbs per bottle. And I'll take, you know, 2 of those in my bike, and I'll just, you know, throw 4 or 5 gels in my pocket. And then, I'll down, you know, one of those 90 gram bottles an hour along with a gel. So I'm getting about 120 grams of carbs every hour during an intense race. And
you'll do that with starting the first hour.
Yeah, immediately. I'll make sure I finish that first bottle by the end of the first hour. Sometimes I won't get a gel down as well, but I know that at least if I'm finishing that bottle, that I'm doing pretty good with fueling. And I mean, the starts are always pretty quick for the first, 10 or 20 minutes. So, I mean, you are getting some carb burning during those first few minutes of the race anyways. So, yeah, it's good to just keep it topped up because it's a drink mix. It goes pretty quick through your system and it doesn't really feel too heavy in your stomach. So you can just keep pumping it in. And as long as we've gone through a few weeks of, building our stomachs up to be able to handle that just through training and getting used to that in training, so that when we get to a race, it doesn't, upset our stomach or anything and we can process it.
How many grams of sodium are you taking in each bottle?
I'm actually not sure. I know it's that information is definitely available on Neversecond website, but
I'll have to look it up.
yeah, I'm not 100% certain on that. Yeah, I'm not sure,
That's good
but
to know. Honestly, I love that you're honest about that because the way that people nerd out about these like splitting hair differences, and not to say that sodium intake is a splitting hair. I mean, it is important. You know, you're getting the sodium in, your team's got your back. There is that layer of protection there. But the questions I get as a trainer are like sometimes people will ask me things and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I want to help and I want to guide you, but I think this doesn't matter. You know what I mean? It's
Yeah,
like,
it's a hard one because I mean everybody burns through sodium at different rates. So I mean, I've never been salty in a bike race in my life, so I know I don't burn through sodium as quick as most other people. So I've never had to really focus on it. I know I have some teammates that they really get into the nitty and gritty of how much they need, and they're, putting half tablets inside of some of their drink mix bottles so that they're hitting that perfect amount. But yeah, for me, like my sweat rate is pretty like the sodium in my sweat like is pretty low. So it's I'm not really losing too much, so I don't have too much to replenish. So it's not something I really need to focus on too much, luckily.
Well, that's interesting to know that, okay, it's not something that's as important for you maybe because the sweat sodium rate is a little bit lower. But I have heard interviews with other riders like Mateo Jorgensen who said they have an abnormally high salt and they're taking salt tabs and all that stuff. So no, it's good to know, man. Everybody is different, even the pros, which is pretty sick. So you start out with the two bottles and two gels in the first couple of hours. And then does anything change as the race progresses?
Yeah, so the staff that are on the side of the road that are giving us food and bottles during the race, they don't normally carry 90 gram bottles, so I typically take a 60. Yeah, I took I think a 60 and a 30. So the carbs I was getting from the bottles went down from that point, but I just followed that up with, an extra two gels each hour. So just kind of made up for it that way. And I just, started with five gels, so it was already enough. And when I grabbed a Musette at like the halfway point, I took out a 60 gram bottle, took out a 30 gram bottle from that bag, threw a couple more gels in my pocket, and that's what took me to the line.
No way. So purely gels and liquids for
Yeah,
4.5 hours.
that was it.
Was there any point where you felt like you could have used a little bit more in your gut, like a little rice cake bar or anything like that?
Not in this race. I would say during stage races, that afterburn effect is pretty intense. So I typically would take on more solids during a stage race. But in a one day race, your body's already so topped up before you start that I tend to not feel the need quite as much for solids unless it's a 7 hour race.
That afterburn is a really great tip. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about it, but it definitely changes the dynamic of nutrition when you're, plugging days on in like that. I love that, dude. Well, thanks for giving us the full breakdown. It's super cool to hear exactly what you're doing, kind of what your mindset is, and then how you were thinking in the race. And then even the fact that you couldn't see at one point during the race and you're just relying on the white line and waiting to see the finish banner, So, is there anything else that you want to kind of add to talk about the day before we roll?
Yeah, not too much, I guess. Yeah, really the theme of the day was just speed, I mean, we focus on power. That's all you really focus on when you're training. And That is so important to give yourself the foundation to get these results. But yeah, at the end of the day, like I said, I probably could have pushed 30 more watts in the last 30K if that was all I was thinking about, or last 13K if that's all I was thinking about. But you know, when it comes to races, speed is the only thing that matters. So yeah, it's good to focus on power when you're training, but you should also practice speed as well. You know, just
that getting used to
what feels faster, what's making you faster, how you're holding your head, and that way when you get to a race, maybe it's a bit more natural.
Beautiful. Absolute mic drop advice right there, dude. Thank you so much. And anything you want to plug before we go? I know that people can go and follow you on Instagram. It's Nielsen.Palace, right?
I believe that's my Instagram handle.
You have to check.
Yeah, double checking now. Nielsen.Palace, no dot.
No dot. Okay, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, go and follow Nielsen on Instagram, you guys. Make sure you keep track of his season because he's already coming in swinging. And big shout out to Education First in general. You guys are having an incredible start to your year. And dude, thank you so much for jumping on this podcast. I know it's going to help a ton, and it was super just fun to get to talk about this thing. So congrats again, and hopefully we can catch up after your next win later this season.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, Dowd fam, as promised, I'm going to give you a little update. We're going to talk about the Pain Cave build out in my garage. I want to tell you about the 2023 Dowd Health collab kits with LEL. And I want to talk about being sick and my mental state, along with the race that I'm hopefully going to do this weekend. So first, let's talk about the Pain Cave build out. It is coming together so good, and I can almost say that it's done. Now, if you aren't familiar with what I'm talking about, Episode 138 gives you really the background into why I decided to close my studio space, my commercial space. And, you know, in a nutshell, it's because I don't train people in person anymore. And it started to feel like a waste, both financially and in how much I had to really take care of the place. And so when I realized I could do it in my garage, I got so set on it. And that process started in December. Now, it wasn't ideal with the holidays, and I have a big, busy family. You know, at one point, you guys, it was the 26th of December, but we had 17 kids over at my house that were under 8 years old with their parents, all opening gifts at the same time. You know that meme where there's a dad and he has a gun and he's like pointing it to someone? He's like, put the trash in the bag. That was basically me with these kids. Sorry if that was a little bit graphic, but you know what I'm talking about? Getting the trash, having kids not fight over toys. You know, I was solving this crazy argument about whose T-Rex was whose with my son and my nephew. It was just mayhem. And to do that without a garage was so much more difficult, because the garage is the place you just throw things and you deal with it later. And my garage before the build out wasn't that messy. It was pretty much a normal garage. It was functional. We had stuff I didn't need. We had stuff I did need. I would say it was just a very standard garage, but now it's probably the most ballin' 450 square feet you can imagine. It's got the raddest gym equipment. It has a perfect turbo setup, and it has everything I need for my bikes, and it's all organized. So I'm very stoked, and I can't wait to show you, and I want you to know that really it's been worth it. You know, the work and the transition, even though there was a point where I almost lost faith and I didn't know if we'd be able to pull it off, it has worked out. And let me dive into that real quick. So we had to build out the garage. We had to put in a ceiling, insulation, lighting, do a ton of drywall, all the texture. And then we had to move everything in from my studio. But also at the same time, I couldn't have anything in my garage. My shed was, you know, bursting at the seams. I had bags of random stuff in my room. I had stuff at my studio. It was all over the place. I mean, there's one ride in particular I remember where I couldn't find my Di2 charger. I couldn't find this. And like, it took 45 minutes to get out the door. And so it was kind of a nightmare, along with the fact that the weather was horrendous for Northern California. The rainiest winter we've ever had, ever, no doubt, especially the second half of December. So trying to keep stuff outside was just not happening. And I needed the garage completely empty. It was wild. So I get to the point where I need to move everything out of my studio into the garage, and I have way too much stuff. And we did it in the rain. Shout out to everyone who showed up to help me. That was incredible. You know you have a real friend when they show up in the rain to help you move and to help you move gym equipment. Everything's heavy, you know? So I was really, really grateful for those guys. And, you know, we moved everything in to the point where even without my bikes in here, you could not walk without stepping over or on top of something. It was so packed. And when I saw that, I honestly was like, first off, how the heck do I move this stuff in a position I want? And also, is this going to freaking work? Am I going to have space to actually do my workouts the way that I want? Or, you know, do I have space for these dumbbell racks that are huge? You know, I don't have an insane amount of equipment, but I did build out a studio to train up to 5 people at once that was 1,000 square feet and dedicated to just that. I didn't have a washer and dryer in it. You know what I mean? So making this thing functional and work was a mission, but I really hung the last thing today. And we're at the point now where we're just waiting on some branding to get on the walls. And I actually stalled that because I wanted to incorporate the kit branding that we do with LEL into the logo somehow, because that's what we did last year. We had this blue, gray, black sort of water swirl design on our kits. And that was sort of our branding theme for the year. And we integrated it into a lot that we did. We did t-shirts, we did stickers, and man, it just worked out really well. So I wanted to do that same thing. And I think this week we're going to lock down the finals on the kits. And so let's move on to that. But just so you know, it is already serving its purpose and making my life so much more effective and efficient. I'm so excited about this next year. Seriously. So let's move on to these kits. I had an idea to do a kit with topography, but also kind of granite and some other earthy designs. And I wanted to incorporate my logo without the stone, which is what we call that sort of, it's not a circle, but it's like this oblong shape behind the D that we use for the majority of our logos. I don't know if I'm going to phase it out completely. I think we need to have variations for our brand, but this year I really want to focus on just the D. And so I didn't really know how we would do that on the kit. And the way they sent back the first art design just absolutely nailed it. I don't want to give it away yet. I sort of sent out a little hint on the newsletter. I didn't tell you where the clip was taken from, but I showed part of it and it just came out so rad. So we're going to add color. And hopefully you guys dig this kit. Mostly black and white with some blue. It's gonna be kind of our gray blue sort of light and mostly black bibs. So it's gonna look clean. And the goal is to have multiple styles. You know, last year I did the full race fit, which is the L cap. And it's just a proper fast race ride. You're gonna go out and try and go for a KOM or you're gonna actually race in it. It's just a perfect kit for that. I mean, this thing's toit. But it fits incredibly comfortably for how tight it is. But then we also did the Diablo in the summer, which it's not as tight, but it's very see-through. So the thing, and it's perfect for really hot days, but what I realized was you got to be willing to like show your body a lot. I mean, even more than normal Lycra kits already do. And there's days, dude, when I want to go out mountain bike, and I don't know, that maybe I had some extra servings at dinner and some ice cream the night before. You know what I mean? Like there's just days where you may not want to be in that snug, like fit looking like you're a stuffed sausage bursting at the seams. You know what I mean? Everybody feels like that from time to time. And I was like, okay, we need a more casual kit because I want people to genuinely love putting this on and feel comfortable with it. And so we decided to also do the Solana kit, which is, it's just more, I don't want to say it's more relaxed. It is. It's still form filling the way that you want. And it's as comfortable as you'd want, but it's just not as like skin tight. There's not as much compression. It's a really, really good everyday kit. And to be honest, I think for most people out riding road, on, you know, a kind of casual ride or out riding gravel, they might want to be in that kit opposed to the full race one or opposed to the one that's like see-through. So hopefully that's a perfect fit for you guys and you have the options that you want. I hope you love the design. Stay tuned because the order window is only going to be for 2 weeks, but it's at wholesale pricing. You don't have to be a member to buy it. We do it this way so that we can get a cheap price, but it's only a 2 week order window for the whole summer kit. So stay tuned. We're also going to have other items. I'm hoping for socks. I'm hoping for vests and long sleeve jerseys as well. The long sleeve Solana jersey, freaking winner, you guys. I love that jersey. Wearing it on a day where it's like 65 degrees, it is just the perfect in between long sleeve, short sleeve. It's not thermal. Absolutely love that kit. So hopefully we'll have those options for you. I haven't talked to them. It was my suggestion, and we'll see what we end up with. But that's pretty much the update on the LEL kits. Now, let's talk about being sick. I got a head cold from my kids. You know, it started, one of them, stuffy nose. The next one, stuffy nose. Third one gets it. And then, you know, you, as a parent, you're just looking at them. You're like, cool. Okay, I got 1 or 2 days before it hits me. And sure enough, it did. Now, it was with me for like 3 or 4 days. And I was actually really proud of myself for not freaking out and just backing off workouts, not overdoing it. I feel like I've really gotten more mature in that sense. I don't need to prove to myself that I can work out when I'm sick. I know I want to. It takes more, honestly, effort to back myself down and not train hard, because I like to work out, man. I like to do hard efforts on the bike. So when I can't, it's frustrating. So I was proud of myself for laying low. And as soon as I felt good, I started bringing up the intensity. And I don't know if I brought it on too soon or what, but I did a sweet spot session. And the day after, well, it was a 2-hour Trainer Road sweet spot session. Pretty tough. But the day after, I just felt horrendous. In fact, I planned on going to the local race ride because I wanted to try and make up for some intensity, especially prepping for this upcoming race. And so I wake up that morning, I feel horrible, like genuinely horrible. And it was funny because I've been tracking my metrics on my Garmin at night. And that's something I actually knew I want to talk about too. But I've been looking at my data and it even said it was like the least amount of REM and deep sleep I've gotten since I started tracking it. And my resting heart rate was like 8 beats higher than it normally is. I mean, it had all the signs of just you don't feel good, but I'm prepping my nutrition. I really want to go ride. And I just told myself, I was like, dude, you know, just go warm up. You might be feel good. You know, the sweet spot session yesterday went fine. I'm rolling out of my house, you guys, and I just felt horrible. Like even doing a warm up pace, like, you know, zone 2, the watts felt kind of heavy. And so I'm pedaling and I'm like, okay, no, you're going to ease into it. You know, you got 45 minutes before you link up with the ride, like shake it out. And then I get to the point where I'm 20 minutes in and I'm like, no, I'm not really feeling any better. Should I even go? And as soon as I had that thought, I get a flat. And of course the flat happened to be one block from like my favorite coffee shop in town. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, dude, I feel like this is the Lord speaking to me right now. I got a flat. I was asking myself if I should go. I feel like absolute garbage. I think I'm just going to go to the coffee shop. And I'm going to tell you guys, this is a hard thing for me because sometimes I have to really ask myself if I'm being a man here, you know, like I have to question it. And the truth is, I think I've proved to myself that I could force myself to do anything, but at the same time, it's like, why? Like, what's the real outcome from it? And am I going to even go out and feel better by doing this ride? Or could I, you know, make the right call, enjoy a nice morning at the coffee shop, recover and come back strong the next week? And that's what I chose to do. And so I ended up going for a really random ride, went to like the top of the parking garage of the mall and on some old bike trails I used to ride when I was a kid. And so it was kind of a fun day out, but today I had to take a rest and hopefully I'll just feel better for the race I'm supposed to do this upcoming weekend. It's about 4 hours away in Bakersfield, California. It's like Central California, and it's called the Rock Cobbler. Now, a lot of you guys have probably seen footage from this last year. This is the one where two people got attacked by bulls. And by attacked, I mean they literally got like picked up off the ground and rammed by bulls out on the prairie. And it was insane. And that's the race I want to go do. Honestly, the Vegan Cyclist has a really good video of just covering the race. It looks so fun. Like it's like 85 miles. I think it's about 8 or 9K of climbing. And it looks like it's, 90% dirt or more. Crazy mixed terrain, single track, tech stuff. You got to get off and hike these sections because they're so steep. It just looks really fun. And I just put 42 tires on my Crux. I got full tread. They're Tracers, I believe. They're Tracers. I'm getting the CX tire mixed up from Specialized, the trigger. But yeah, it just looks incredible. The Crux is ready to go. And I just hope my body's ready. You know, I came off of January being like the best training month I've ever had. Most of my weeks were closer to 10 hours. I had a lot of really good intensity, some double days, and I ended up going for a ride with the highest power and average speed I've ever had on a ride like that. And it was like a, I think it was like a 70 or 80 mile ride or something. It just felt incredible. And I could tell that that extra volume paid off in the intensity. And I guess I'm bringing it up because it was one of the first times I've put real extra effort into training and had it immediately followed up by sickness. And I've heard people talk about how frustrating this is because you feel like you lost what you just gained. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but it is something I had to check myself because I found myself getting frustrated about it. And I think it's legit, but at the same time, it's like, you guys, is it really that big of a deal? You know, not to get too heavy, but I have a brother-in-law who just almost died from bone cancer. You know, he had to get a bone marrow transplant recently. And like, you start thinking about this, like, it's just crazy how blessed we are to be healthy and to go ride our bikes, that even if I was to miss this race this weekend, it's not a big deal. It isn't, you know? And I guess it's just a reminder as to why you put in the work when you do, when your body's ready for it. And ultimately, I feel hungrier than ever to keep that training up and just have an incredible year at these events. So anyways, that's the update, you guys. I'm loving life. I hope you're doing well. Let's go to the outro. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dialed Health Podcast. Remember, you can find a portion of this episode up on YouTube. Go to Dialed Health and you can see my entire interview with Nielsen Palace. You'll get some visuals, and that will be up a little bit later than the time this drops, just so you guys know. I post those mid-Monday PST time, opposed to first thing in the morning like this podcast. So if there is a delay, that's why. But please go and subscribe to the YouTube channel. I really want to get more content up there for you guys. And in the comments, you can let me know what topic you want me to discuss next. Give that thing a thumbs up. And also make sure that you share this podcast to your social media. You can screenshot that you're listening to it and put it on your Instagram story, tag Dialed Health, or simply send it to a friend and make sure that both you and them are subscribed. So thanks again for listening to this episode. Until next week, start moving forward.